Hey, this is Brandi Clark, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to episode number 166 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. Now, you may have noticed that I'm a little late getting this one up. Originally, I had it set up to be released a week and a half ago or so, but with all the unrest going on in the world, I don't know, it just didn't feel right, so I took it down. Between the protests and the looting and the police violence, I know everybody's feeling a mix of emotions out there, and some people, maybe a majority of people, wish that musicians like me would just shut the F up and stick to the music. But you know that ain't me. I gotta talk about what's going on in the world. So, as much as I don't like seeing neighborhoods I frequent get looted and torn apart, personally, my instinct is to be on the side of the protesters. And I think there's an important distinction to be made in most cases between protesters and rioters. But even with the rioters, I'm not going to wag my finger in people's faces about destruction of property and whatnot in situations like these. I just try to put myself in other people's shoes. But honestly, like, I can't really imagine what it would be like to live in a neighborhood where militarized domestic police forces behave like invading armies. And how many people out there listening to this right now can truly comprehend what that would do, to have it in the back of your mind at all times that your safety, or your children's safety, or your wife's, or brother's, or mother's, or father's safety is at risk 24/7 from the very people supposedly tasked with keeping law and order in your neighborhood. So yeah, I'm gonna refrain from being too judgmental about rioters. And I know there's a segment of listeners out there that wanna believe that all the problems in the world begin and end with President Trump. But I strongly encourage you folks to think about the big picture of our system here as a whole. You know, it's the rotten system that allows police officers to kill black men and women, generally without consequence, is the same rotten system that belched up Trump as a viable candidate for president in the first place. You know, it's the same rotten system that gave us the war on drugs and broken windows policing and the militarization of domestic police forces. And it's the same rotten system that values Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, Silicon Valley, big oil, and anyone else that can afford a lobbyist to buy off our elected officials. It's the same rotten system that leaves so many of us to always have to vote for the least worst candidate instead of someone who we truly believe in. And for that matter, it's the same rotten system that offers up Joe Biden by the Democratic Party, quote-unquote, resistance, a candidate with his own horrible record on civil rights, the chief architect of the 1994 crime bill, a writer of the Anti-Drug Abuse Acts of 1986 and 1988, and the Comprehensive Control Act, which was co-written with Strom Thurmond, who Biden eulogized at Thurmond's funeral. I think he was the only Democrat to do that. Here's a quote that I pulled off of Vox, and this is referring to something Biden said during President George H.W. Bush's term. It says here, Biden even went on national television to criticize a plan from President George H.W. Bush to escalate the war on drugs. The plan, Biden said, didn't go far enough. Biden added, doesn't include enough police officers to catch the violent thugs, not enough prosecutors to convict them, not enough judges to sentence them, and not enough prison cells to put them away for a long time. Now, whether Biden is a dyed-in-the-wool racist or just a craven political opportunist, I don't know, but it amounts to the same thing policy-wise. So, as inept and immoral as Trump is, let's be honest with ourselves about our corporate political system as a whole. These issues that are coming to a head right now have a long, sordid history right here in America. Haven't we all had enough? All right, let's get to the interview. So this interview with Brandi Clark kind of hit the sweet spot for me for how I like things to go on this podcast, because she's easy to talk to, and it really just felt more like I was having a conversation with a friend, even though we'd only kind of met, you know, a few days prior to this when she was a guest on that Luck Reunion Hello Walls episode that I'd hosted. I noticed that night that Brandy just had that that kind of intangible quality that seasoned pros tend to have. It's a confidence, I think, not only in fielding questions, but also singing and playing, performing. And I remember thinking afterwards, like, wow, she really kind of classed that up at the end, because she closed it out. She was my last guest, and the whole night was great, but I remember thinking, wow, I don't know. That's something about her, you know? And that that theme kind of continues here in this interview, where for some reason my microphone sounds terrible and hers sounds totally amazing. You'd almost get the sense that she was the podcaster and I was the podcastee. And that might be because during her coronavirus lockdown time, she's been keeping herself busy interviewing other artists herself on her online show, You Can't Come Over, But You Can Come In, which is great. I highly recommend it. And you should go watch it as soon as you finish listening to this interview here. I can't remember now off the top of my head if it's hosted through her Instagram account or YouTube or something, but whatever. Go check out her social media and you'll find it for sure. And while you're at it, make sure you go listen to her latest record. It's produced by Jay Joyce and it's called Your Life is a Record, and it's fantastic. So without further ado, this is Brandy Clark on Walking the Floor.
I wanna be the me you should be when we were together.
First off, thank you for doing that Luck Reunion Hello Wall show with me the other night. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, thanks for having me. I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, I enjoyed watching everybody and Hayes Carl being by candlelight.
Yeah.
I don't know how he did it, because I have several people in Nashville don't have power even still.
Oh, really? From that storm just a couple nights ago, a few nights ago now.
Or Wi-Fi. I was just talking to a friend, doesn't have any Wi-Fi, kind of in the dark.
That's a real live stream trooper right there, Hayes Carl. You made it happen. It's funny, with all this live streaming that we're all doing now, I've found, because I've done a bunch in the last week and a half or so, where I take over somebody else's Instagram handle or Facebook handle or whatever. And I find the one common thread between it all is the instructions I get. Because I'm I've never live streamed or done any of that in my life until now. And I'm a little bit of a Luddite, with it all. It's not really native to me. But I find that everybody's instructions are just wrong enough to make me really confused.
Well, and see, I'm like you. I've not done a lot of it. I've done a few Facebook Lives in the past, but nothing like what's going on now. And I feel like every big show you do has a different operating system.
Right.
And I just feel lucky that my manager has a girl that works with her that is just so tech savvy. Because I did one yesterday for Music Cares, and you had to have a new system, and she was like, let me screen share. She set it up, did the whole thing. And if I didn't have her, I don't know what I'd do.
Yeah, same thing. I mean, I find myself scrambling 5 minutes before every one of these things is supposed to start. I can't make it work. What is going on? But whatever, we're all getting through it. I'm curious, and I always forget to ask people about this stuff, but I just, we're all immersed in music and immersed in our own careers and all that stuff so much that I just want to talk to people about, what do you do besides music? What has this time spent forced to be home allowed you, what has it given you the opportunity to do or spend your time with that isn't music related?
Well, that's a great question. Two things, I'm a former athlete. I played basketball. I played volleyball, basketball, track growing up. I went to a small school. So if you played one sport, you did all of them. And so I've always been somewhat active. Now, I've always liked to eat a lot too. So anytime I go to a trainer, they always say to me, man, you're in better shape than I would have thought. So one thing, I was thinking about it. I have a woman that I work out with in Nashville and can't because of this. And she does online training. That's actually how I met her. I was in Dallas working on a project. So before I worked out with her in Nashville, I was working out with her remotely. Well, I never go to her 3 times a week. Like, there's always something that comes up. But during this time, I have. And it's because I don't have an excuse. Like,
right.
I just get, and it's also one of my few outside connections. Like,
I'll go
to bed and think, oh, I get to work out with Katie tomorrow. So that, and then also, sorry about my little dogs. They're
so, that's okay.
Must be a bird outside. And so then also, you know, I try to read a lot. And
I saw you have Brandy's book club. I was actually going to ask you about, what are you reading? What's on your reading list right now?
Well, right now we're reading Daisy Jones and the Six, which I have read that book. It's crazy. This book club started because last year I made a goal to read 24 and I read 21, which was hard.
It's a lot of books.
Yeah. Even in this quarantine, I'm not keeping up with last year's pace. I don't know how I did it, but I posted a picture of a book and somebody said, oh, we should do a book club. And I was feeling overzealous that day. So I said, okay. And so I was starting a tour on, I was supposed to be starting a tour March 28th that has been moved. And I had a coffee partnership. And so we were going to turn Soundcheck into coffee and a book and do this book club, different book every month. I'm shocked at how many people love to read. And that does my heart good, actually.
Sure.
If I weren't a writer, I wouldn't be a reader. I didn't grow up reading. My parents probably would have liked me to read more. I read what I had to read, but as an adult, being a songwriter, you're always needing those ideas, and reading just gets my brain in the rhythm of language. So I've read a lot as an adult. And that's how this book club started. And then, when the tour got canceled, my manager said, or I shouldn't say canceled, postponed. My manager said, let's just do it online. And I didn't think it would work, but the second book we read is a book called Untamed, by a woman named Glennon Doyle. And she actually joined me on the live feed.
Oh,
and
wow.
The book club shot from 125 to over 700. Just boom, there we were. So it's crazy what has happened with this book club.
I tell you, the best thing I ever did, I read a lot too. And the best thing I've done in recent years for my reading is get readers. Because I realized I would read a couple pages every night and fall asleep because I couldn't see anymore, you know? So I recently, our other guitar player, Pat, on tour last fall was like, you know, I can tell by how you're reading that book, you need glasses. Go to CVS and get some readers. And I did, and that changed it for me. I can read so much more now. It's great.
I should maybe get readers. I'm not a very fast reader. Maybe that would help me. And I have terrible vision. Like whenever I tell people my contact prescription, they're like, wow, you are blind. And if I'm wearing glasses, they're just Coke bottles. So at this point, I probably need readers too.
It's funny, I actually made an effort. It was a while ago now, maybe like 10 years ago. I kind of realized all I ever read are books on politics and current events and history. I need to read more classic fiction. I just need more fiction in my life. And I just made a hard left turn into only reading fiction for a long time. Now I kind of mix it up, but I felt like that had a really good impact just on songwriting and just keeping that side of your brain kind of going.
Fiction does, but I'll tell you, I can't read fiction as quickly as I can read nonfiction. And I think it's because you don't have, you have the characters already in your mind, you know what they look like, you know what they sound like.
Right.
During this time, so when this whole coronavirus started, I was talking to a friend of mine, he's a little bit older, and I said, what do you think of this? And he's a real smart guy, and he said, you know, me of AIDS. And I said, it does? And he said, yeah, I was living in New York when AIDS started and nobody really knew what it was. And so I go down some rabbit holes, and so I started reading that book, and the band played on. More than AIDS, it's just about the struggle to get people to pay attention to it, what the doctors and researchers were up against and fighting it. And sure enough, about halfway through, Dr. Fauci, like, he was one of the key people in figuring all that out.
Really?
Yes.
I read an interesting article the other day that was kind of a downer, really. It was the point of it was, or the slant on it was, hey, you know what? We might not ever have a vaccine for this thing, and we might just have to learn to live with it like we did with this, and this. And one of those examples was AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's scary to me when I had to quit watching the news, and I also quit reading that book. A little bit past halfway through, I quit reading because it's scary. Because I was a little kid then, so I don't.
Sure.
My first like major memory of AIDS, other than being scared of it, was when Magic Johnson was HIV positive. Because
right,
he was my favorite. He's still my favorite NBA player of all time, and I was devastated. I remember where I was when I heard about it. But so the scary thing in that book, based like if you compare it to coronavirus, is, you know, they were just, it was like whack-a-mole, you know, literally like they thought it was one thing and then they thought it was another and then it was this. And what they found out was all of those things were AIDS related. And so
right.
Now, not to get so deep but or dark, but, you know, now they're, first it was just respiratory things with coronavirus, and then all these other things start popping up.
Sure.
And this is too.
I absolutely, I know exactly what you're talking about. And because I'm, you know, when you think about it, and we're only a couple of months into this, and when you think about all the initial things when the lockdown first started was, okay, it doesn't affect children, and it really only affects old people with, you know, that are immunocompromised and this sort of thing. It turned out none of that's true, you know, and now, kind of like what you're saying, now there's like new strains of it popping. I mean, it's like, I think we're in that phase of just like not knowing. And that's kind of, that's the scariest part, is the not knowing what you're even really up against.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, it's so scary. And, you know, at some point, I guess we'll look back on this and say, you know, hopefully we lived through that.
Right.
But it's, I've talked to people who are much older. You know, I have a friend who's in his 80s, and he said, you know, this is the hardest thing I've ever seen the world go through in my lifetime. And that's scary when you think about somebody that's of that age saying that.
Oh, for sure. Well, we've kicked this off in super doom and gloom. let's shift gears to your You Can't Come Over, But You Can Come In series, which I love. I love seeing that you're keeping so busy. It's great. And like, did you have those sort of like a yearning to do more beyond, you know, being a singer, songwriter before the lockdown?
You know what's funny in doing this? Because this was just, this You Can't Come Over But You Can Come In, which, by the way, was not, I have a song called You Can Come Over But You Can't Come In. And there were three titles that my social media guy suggested, and that was the third one. And I was like, people aren't going to get that. I didn't say that, but that's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
and
sure.
The other ones were so amazing to me. It was like quarantunes, all this stuff.
Right.
So, on the first one, I said, hey, you know, we got to name this. What do you guys think? It was an overwhelming, there was nobody that said anything but You Can't Come Over, But You Can Come In. You know what's funny? So that was, it was just a necessary way since this tour got moved to be able to get my music in front of people. But what I realized in it is that I do have that love of sitting down and being the interviewer versus the interviewer.
It's fun, right?
It is.
And it's like, when else do you get a chance to talk to all these cool musician people? You know, it's like, usually, like, if you and I interacted, it would be like at a festival or something somewhere, and I'd meet you for 2 minutes, maybe, and we'd have some small talk conversation, and we wouldn't talk about any of this stuff. And that's the thing that I love about doing the podcast or any of these kind of things.
Yeah. You know, and I had Mary Chapin Carpenter on yesterday, and I literally had met her once at the UK Americana UK Awards backstage. We hugged. I said, oh, I've always been a big fan. The other thing it allows me with someone like her, who I would be pretty intimidated by to sit down with, doing it this way, some of that intimidation goes away for some reason.
Right.
And it's, I don't know, it's when I was a little girl, I wanted to be Barbara Walters, and all of this has definitely, I'm like, oh, I remember, you know, I always liked that person that was on the other side of the interview.
Totally. Yeah. It's great. It makes it like, it's funny. It has the, it has had the effect on me of like, I kind of like respect people who do this for a living more. I respect the good ones more. And it makes me look at the ones, because, you know, we all do a lot of kind of crummy interviews where you get asked the same handful of questions over and over. And it makes me look at those folks and go, come on, man. Pick up the pace.
Totally. Always had a lot of, I always get frustrated with what I would consider a lazy journalist.
Right.
Who just asks questions from your bio that's 6 years old.
Right.
When you've just done a new one. You know,
right.
That
can frustrate
me really bad.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be that to anybody.
Totally.
That I have on, you know, I want to ask them current questions, and especially, you know, some of these people that I've been a fan of their music forever. I don't want my one interaction with them to be, yeah, that was a waste of my time. I don't know why I did it.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Well, what, I don't remember if it was you. I watched the one you did with Charlie Warsham. I don't remember if it was you or him that said this, but it struck a nerve with me. And that was, that you're getting a lot of joy out of cleaning the house. I related to that so much. I mean, I don't know what your home situation is exactly. I have three teenage boys, and so it's me and my wife and three teenage boys and a dog and a cat and a bird. So there's a lot of action, and we spend a lot of time. Almost like all of our time is spent either, you know, making a mess or cleaning that mess up. So I've dug into that, and in particular, making my bed in the morning has become this sort of like zen moment for me. I don't know why.
For me, it's mopping the floor. You know, I have where I'm at right now, there's no carpet. It's all these beautiful like cement floors that are tough to clean. And I think that's part of it, is they're tough to clean. And some of the somebody didn't seal all the grout. So it's always my goal when I sweep, there are these big sections to not get any dirt in those cracks, because that makes me crazy. I like any kind of a household chore that feels real accomplished when it's done.
Yes.
I always used to love to mow the lawn and, you know, watch the lines as you did it and keep it really sweet. Maybe I'm OCD. I don't think of myself that way, but mopping a floor is the same way for me.
There's something so satisfying about that feeling at the end of the day when everything's in its rightful place, you know, in your home. I just dig that. It's funny. I've found that I spent the first several weeks of this thing avoiding doing big projects like cleaning my entire garage or whatever it is. And I've sort of settled into just doing a series of very small projects, even like just clean one drawer in my bathroom. You know, so it's like that level of sort of micromanagement, you know what I mean? When you just sort of break it down to those little spaces, it seems so much more manageable.
It is. You know, I think it's so easy in this time to think, well, first of all, when it started, I definitely didn't think it would last as long as it has.
Sure.
But you're like, I feel like the first 10 days was like that time between Christmas and New Year's when all bets are off and you're just like, doing what you want to do all the time within your home.
Yeah.
But then as it went on, and then it was like, okay, well, I need to set some goals. And when we came into this, I was having some shoulder issues just from like overuse playing guitar. So I got this octave mandolin. Was like, okay, I'm going to learn that.
Nice.
And so I started that, and then I realized, okay, let's learn to play a song. The other way, it's just more than you can choose, so you don't do any of it.
I think it's really hard, or at least it's hard for me, you know, as a longtime guitar player and a guitar player in a certain style. I find that if I don't really immerse myself in something, like I have so many good intentions instrument purchases, a pedal steel, a dobro, a mandolin, a banjo. I have all that stuff, you know, and I periodically spend a little bit of time kind of with each one of them. But if I don't actually, like, I'll never learn how to play the banjo right unless I go become a banjo player in somebody's band for a year. You know what I mean? I just know that about maybe right now is that time to have that.
Yeah, I mean, I did write on it. I've written on it twice now. And, you know, and when I've done that, I've been like, no, you're not picking up the guitar. You're just playing this. And that helps. But it's like, I almost feel like I've done some things with Marty Stewart, who I love.
Yeah.
And this woman who works with him, who I also love, tweeted at me when she saw that I got that and said, oh, you should learn such and such. It's Marty's favorite song or something. I was thinking, I almost feel like I need to pretend like I have to play a song for Marty.
Right. Yeah. That's the pressure you need to actually get fluid on that thing for sure. I mean, God, Marty Stewart, what a super duper shredder. Wasn't he like a mandolin like prodigy as a kid? Wasn't he like,
yes.
Isn't that when he got his start?
I think he came to Nashville when he was like 13 and was, I think it was Lester Scruggs, Earl Scruggs, Lester Flatt. My brain's not working all the way. I think he was in, and I also want to say that he was, oh dang it, I am looking really stupid because my brain's not firing on all cylinders. Long story short, he was a bluegrass prodigy. I mean, much like Ricky Skaggs and Keith
Whitley, right.
I think all those guys played together
as
youngsters, you know. Marty came to Nashville at 13. He also met Connie Smith and said, I'm going to marry her as a little boy.
I think he has a picture of himself getting an autograph from her when he's a little boy. Like I think he has the moment he met her, like a photo of it.
It's the sweetest thing ever. They interviewed him about it in the Ken Burns Country Music documentary. And it was one of the three times I cried in that documentary because it's so sweet. And he taught, his mom had a camera. And so I think about, you know, that was back before cell phones and there were probably 12 chances for a picture on that camera.
Right. Yeah.
And there's a picture of him and his sister with Connie and she's got her arms around him. And then he said, Mom, I want to try to get another picture of her. Can I have your camera? And she gave him her camera and he ran and Connie was getting into this car and he took a picture of her getting into the car. And when he got back into his car with his mom, he said, I'm going to marry her someday. Like just as this little boy.
Yeah, you can't make that step up.
No. It's so sweet. And they have such a sweet, I've been really fortunate. There are two people that I've gotten to be around that are really, you know, country music royalty to me. And they're just such nice people, both of them. And, you know, along with being legends.
Do you ever hit Marty up for like the super VIP mandolin lesson FaceTime session?
Maybe I should. Maybe that needs to be one of the, you can't come over, but you can come in.
Session. Oh my God. Are you kidding? That's like custom made. Yeah.
Great idea. Great idea.
You know, you talk about, having like, you know, your brain not functioning as fast as you want it to at some of these times. But I interviewed Marty a few years ago, and at the end, he played a song, and he was like, hey, grab your guitar, play with me. I was like, I was so petrified, nervous. And he goes, hey, let's play Waymore's Blues. And I just couldn't remember the chords to it. Like, my mind went blank. And I think about that every time I hear that song. I go, oh, my God. God, I can't believe my one moment to pick with Marty Stewart. I blew it that hard.
Oh, yeah. No, I understand. Bill Monroe was the name I was searching for. When you started saying that, it popped into my head. No, it's true. You do. It's hard. It's part of why I'm happy that these You Can't Come Over sessions have turned into Zoom sessions.
Right.
Because it turned into that because everything kept crashing on when it was completely live. But it makes it a little easier for me because also there's not people commenting like ask this, ask that, play this, play that.
It's so distracting. You know what I find amazingly distracting is just looking at your phone at your own image. I'm like, it's the last thing on earth I want to do is watch myself play while I'm playing.
Totally. And yesterday I did this Music Cares thing, and it was myself, Cam, Skip Marley, Steve Earle, and Lucinda Williams.
Oh, wow.
It was great. And I was the second to last person to go. They did it in a round. And so this whole time I'm watching everyone else do it and have different stages of freezing up. And I'm thinking, how are they doing that and not messing up? Like, and so I'm getting in my head, like, okay, when you sing, just keep singing. Don't,
right.
You know, but then when it comes to me, they did something where they turned that off, that second feed. And so it's fine. But I spent the first, so it would have been four songs before myself. I spent the first three songs thinking, how am I going to do this?
Right.
The other thing this does, it's such a tough time because of, I feel like with this quarantine, like, you know, I have so many nights of like, oh, why did I just eat all that? You know, all that kind of feeling. And then I've never had to look at myself so much. Like,
right.
Constant looking at yourself. Yeah.
And looking at yourself under really unfriendly lights, like your cell phone doesn't really make you, you know, like we're not like on a TV set right now with like beautiful lights blowing you out, making you look good. You know what I mean? I know exactly what you mean. It's funny.
Yeah. I know. I always say the least, if you want to feel bad about yourself, FaceTime somebody. Like,
right.
So that's what we're doing all the time now. FaceTime each other.
Yeah, we will never need high production value or applause ever again.
I do love your applause thing you have. That was
amazing. Oh yeah, that's good. That's going to come into every live stream from now on for sure. Hey, let's talk about your latest record. Your Life is a Record. I was wondering if you could kind of explain for people that are going to listen to this. Like, I've often heard the term Memphis Strings. Mm-hmm. You know, refer to what does that mean exactly? Like, what are Memphis Strings versus Nashville Strings or anybody else's strings? Like, what is that?
You know, I still don't really know. I really like them. I can tell you that when this record started, I made this record with Jay Joyce.
Sure.
And he and I made my last record as well. But we sat down, and you know, neither of us want to repeat ourselves. And I said, I thought it'd be fun with a guy like him, who's so known for kind of a heavier, more aggressive electric sound, to challenge him to cut all acoustic. And and I didn't know if he would like that idea, but when I said it, it was like a kid with a train set. Ooh, I love that, you know, let's do that.
Does he play on your record too when he's producing it?
He does. And he probably played more this time than last time even. He called me real excited about the idea and said, let's just cut it with four of us. He's like, myself, you, Jed Hughes, who plays anything, and Giles Reeves, who plays percussion and piano. And I was like, I love that. And we want nothing electric. You know, he's talking to me. And I said, now, Jay, you know, if we need an electric sound, it's okay. And he said, I know, but I do better to paint myself in a corner, more creative that way. We all will be. So along the way, he says to me, you know, what can we do that would take this and put it in a little different place than just every other acoustic singer-songwriter record? I love strings. And I said, what about strings? He's like, strings are hard to cut. It takes a lot of them to sound good. I don't know. Then he calls me that night and said, you know, you said strings. He's like, what if we did Memphis strings and horns? And I said, okay, well, you know, I mean, I trust the guy's amazing. I think when you make a record with somebody, you need to give them a rope. And
sure.
But I didn't even really know what that meant. He said, listen to, you know, Dusty in Memphis and I Am Shelby Lynn and some Bobby Gentry. That's what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. So I did all that. And then we sent three songs to them to do in Memphis. And at the time we were just trying it. And when it came back, he said, now don't be shocked because this won't be what you expect.
Wait, so you actually sent it to a string section in Memphis?
Yes.
Like there's still a string section in Memphis that's functional that you can work with.
Yes.
Wow.
He knew them. I don't think he had ever worked with them. He'd worked on projects that they had played on. But I don't think even as a producer, I think as a player. And so the first three came back. He said, it's not going to sound like what you expect. Well, I didn't really have any expectation of anything. I was just blown away by what it was. And I still can't tell you the difference between like Memphis strings and horns versus Nashville strings, except I think that they're less glossy. You know, that there are parts in those strings that are wrong, technically wrong. You know,
like don't follow the rules of four part, whatever, all that stuff, right.
And I think the horns has a lot to
parallel fifths or whatever, some of that stuff is happening.
I think the horns have a lot to do with what's different too than a typical, or the horns don't sound like an orchestral horn section. I just know I loved it, you know, and when I've heard those, you know, what I would now say, oh, those are Memphis strings and horns, on records in the past, I've always loved them.
What's it with Jay Joyce, like what type of producer is he? Does he get into your songs and arrangement? Like, do you write with him or do you bring in a bunch of songs already fully written?
You know, I've written with him some. We've never cut anything that we've written. We've written very little. But in my case, mostly, you know, he's, both times I've worked with him, I've brought him in, you know, like 18, 24 songs, somewhere in there.
Oh, wow. And
he's
a lot of songs.
Yeah, and he's never heard any of them. And those are kind of the songs that myself and management and the label are all loving. And he's been great because he hasn't heard those songs. So he's really good at saying, I think it's these.
Right.
And he knows what he does well. And he can hear something that maybe I think, I don't know. I mean, that song to me, if we're talking about the core, it feels kind of out here. And he can hear that and say, oh, I know exactly what to do with that to make it so it feels like the center of the record.
Right.
He is the most, I feel like I've been really fortunate to work with a lot of really amazing musicians and songwriters and producers. He is the most, not only is he a genius, in my opinion, he's the most creative person I've ever met. Like, his life is just creativity. He gets up in the morning to create and only goes to sleep, I think, because he's just worn himself out. He is, he, you know, he's just on this planet to create art.
You know, I know you come out of a music row background before you got a deal as a solo artist, right? And I wanted to ask you about your songwriting. I'm asking in context of my own experience. I find when I write with other people, there's two things I do. I either come in with like a fully written song and then work with somebody to like tear it apart and rewrite it and make it better, which I always feel like is, I don't know. I always feel like whoever I'm writing with is like, dude, you wrote a whole song. Like, that's you're cheating or whatever. Or I go in with really no ideas and then I feel like, that's not really my comfort zone. What is it for you? Like, what do you bring into those sessions? Like a little snippet? Do you bring a tagline? Like, do you bring some chord? Like, what do you sort of go into those co-writes with?
You know, I usually, when I step into a co-write, I have it's on my phone now. I used to keep it on a notepad, a list of ideas. And then some days I might have an idea for years, but the day that a conversation might make me think that person would understand that idea or some piece of music they have that would go with that. And then I also have musical ideas on my phone and in my voice memos where, you know, I don't know what this music goes to, but somebody else might say something and I'll think, ooh, that might work with that music. I try to bring in, you know, I've done what you're talking about and I'm never happy when I bring something in that is half finished or, you know, almost done. I never bring that in and I'm happy with what ends up with it. I feel like the songs are better just left 100% written by me because, right, I've gotten that far with them. And some, and I've learned, like, because sometimes I do that because I'm just stuck.
Right.
And then it, and I should just stay the course and wait it out. I feel like for me in a co-write, sometimes the less I go in with, the better.
Right. And is that a comfortable place for you to just be, just kind of just really in the moment with starting from scratch?
It is. Now, I think it took me years, and for years I was, and it also took me finding the right collaborators, because, you know, I was a full-time staff writer on Music Row for over a decade, where that was, you know, 5 days a week I was going in and writing with other people or writing by myself, and making my own records took me out of that to a certain extent. But when I'm not on the road and when I am writing, I'm back in that groove. And sometimes, you know, you need a little breath. I mean, there's good and bad to that. You know, the good thing is your skills are sharpened.
Right.
The bad thing is I think you can get, you can kind of lose your excitement for it, and it can become just like, you know, rote. Like, okay, let me finish this song so I can go home.
Right.
I don't like feeling like that.
Sure.
I was writing on here the other day, somebody I'd never with, and our first write was a Zoom, and I was really honest. I said, look, this either goes really well or it doesn't, and, you know, I find that my attention span for this way of writing is about 2 to 3 hours.
Right.
And I looked up 5 hours later and we had a song, and there came a point, I was thinking about it, there's always a point for me where I don't want to leave. Like, ooh, I don't care how long it takes. I love this so much. I want it perfect. And not perfect in everybody else's mind, but where we've told this story, in my opinion, perfectly.
Right.
And that's, I think, the key to co-writing is, for me, is finding those people that their idea of what it should be aligns, where we align and trust each other, like each other's instincts enough to follow. Not every day. I mean, some days I might be the leader, and then other days I might be the follower, and just I'm helping somebody else with their vision. And I work really well with people that are okay to trade that off. I don't do so well with people that always have to be in the lead.
Is that a typical thing in like those sort of 3-person writing sessions? Are there people who are just sort of known for, like, they come in with the idea and everybody else has to get in line?
Yeah, I think, and you know, too, the other thing, if I'm writing with another artist that's that way, that's fine. You know, if I'm sitting down with you to write for your record, I want you to lead the way. I want to help you say what you want to say. But yeah, there are in a three-way write, you can't have 3 leaders. I mean, you can't, you know,
it just
won't work. And I feel pretty comfortable, I think, because I don't do it as much as I used to. This quarantine is making me do it more, but I used to write almost all the time by myself. And in doing that, I learned how to carry the music if I have to, and carry the lyric and carry the idea. So I feel pretty confident in doing all 3 of those things, depending on what the write needs. I'm probably the least confident in carrying the music. And I don't know why that is, because in situations where I'm forced to do that, the result tends to be pretty good. I think maybe it's because it feels harder to me to come up with fresh musical ideas. And you know, we get so used to ourselves that feels like not fun.
Right.
So it usually takes somebody saying, no, I love what you're playing. Let's chase that, for me to slip into that role of driving the ship musically.
Yeah, it's interesting, because when you start to recognize your own sort of habits in chord changes and things, that's for me when I go like, oh, come on, I always do that. I need to get somebody else's eyes on this thing. But now, I imagine with your mandolin skills, it's opening up new plateaus, right?
Well, part of why I love doing some, making myself write on that mandolin or putting my guitar in an odd tuning, is it does force me, I feel like it forces me to go to new places. But then when I sit down and be like, okay, now what is this on guitar? I tend to go to the same spots.
But you know, that's a really interesting thing, where when you can hear just a 1-4-5 chord progression played on a different instrument, or like you said, in a different tuning, and it sounds fresh. Well, who cares if it's something you've done 1,000 times? You know, that for me, that's, there's a real like liberation in that too, I feel like.
Yeah, you know, and I find like, I don't know, I'm not a piano player. I majored in music for a little bit and had to learn enough piano, and it made me wish I would have started on piano. I always said, right, if I had a kid that loved music, I would really push them to play piano first, because my understanding of music changed when I learned piano, because I could see it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this makes sense now. But if I sit down at the piano, I can play the same chords and write a way different melody.
Right.
Just so big and all there.
Yeah, and it all sounds huge and grand. Yes. And yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, one last thing I wanted to ask you about, I was just curious about, how did you wind up working with Randy Newman? And I'm also, part of that question is, I'm wondering if that's somebody who's like, is he a big influence on you? And I imagine he doesn't just work with anybody. It's funny, my own understanding of his music, like when I was a little kid, he had that big sort of novelty hit with Short People or whatever. And that's the only thing I ever thought of Randy Newman until he started doing like big Disney soundtracks and that whole thing. And it was so long after the fact that I got turned on to records like Good Old Boys and stuff, where I was like, whoa, he's got this deep work, you know?
Well, I think I've always been a Randy Newman fan, even though I didn't know it, because of his work in movies. And he, you know, it feels like he's just all, he feels like one of those artists to me that's kind of everywhere. Right. You know, yeah, I think if you're a songwriter, you're influenced by him in some way. That came about though, so the song Bigger Boat that he's on, that wasn't a duet. I've always wanted to do a duet on one of my albums. I've done duets, but it's always been for other projects. And it's just about finding the right song. And when we were cutting that, my manager said, you know, after it was done, like long done, actually, said, you know, that would be a great duet. I was like, oh. And she started talking about all these different, they were all male artists, but they were all legend status, you know. And I said, what about Randy Newman? And because to me, it just sounded like him. And she said, well, that's a great idea, but I just don't know how we're going to get to him. And one of the A&R guys on this project for me was Lenny Warnaker at Warner. And I knew that Lenny had known Randy his whole life. And so I said, well, let's ask Lenny, you know, what's to lose. And Lenny asked him, and he said, you know, I'll do it if I like it. So that felt like one bridge crossed, you know.
Right.
Okay, well, we got to him. And then I was nervous, like, oh, what if he doesn't like it? Because I could tell by the way Lenny said it, if he didn't like it, he wouldn't do it.
Right.
And so then he said, he likes it, he'll do it. That felt like a win. But you got to wait till he's done with Toy Story 4, which I always loved that too. So on Memorial Day, he did it on Memorial Day, which was really amazing that he took his Memorial Day to do it. And he changed a line, because there was a line, the line, give me that hammer, somebody hold my coat. That was his line. We had, the shit's been hitting the fan a little closer to home. And he didn't want to say shit, which I felt kind of bad then. But I love a curse word in a song. And
me too.
So yeah, oh, I love that song you played the other night. I thought, that's a man after my own heart. And so he, it was so funny. He said, I changed that line, you know, I don't shit. Mine's better anyway. And I do, and I agree with that, actually. He goes, now don't worry, I'm not one of those rappers that's going to want writing credit. And so I kind of wish you
would. You're probably like, I want to co-write with Randy Newman. Are you kidding?
Yes. Yeah, I know.
Put that on the resume.
And I wrote that with a guy named Adam Wright. And I would usually not do this, but I was like, if Randy wants writing credit, I'm just going to give it to him right here.
Right.
Because I think Adam would have probably loved it too. But,
sure. That's amazing. That's so cool. Thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Chris. You're such a good interview. I knew the other night, I thought, oh, this is going to be fun. Like, you know, I feel like the people who are good interviewers, I mean this as a compliment, they're fine to talk about themselves. And it makes the person that they're talking to comfortable to talk, to open up and talk about themselves as well. And you're really good at that.
Thank you so much. Well, luckily I had, you know, 6 or 7 years of podcasting to prepare for the pandemic lockdown.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I hope, you know, I hope we cross paths soon.
Me too. Somewhere we can like hug.
Yeah, exactly. If hugging comes back. Yeah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, you heard that. Brandi Clark promised me a hug when the world gets back to normal right here on Walking the Floor. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com where I will put some links up so you can find find where Brandi's at and what she's doing, and check out all her stuff. And we will be back in a week with my interview with Ketch from Old Crow Medicine Show. So tune in then. That's it for this week, kids. Adios, amigo! I wanna be-